100 years ago, the Representation of the People Act was passed, which gave some women the right to vote in UK general elections for the very first time. The focus on early female suffrage campaigners in the UK tends to centre on the actions of the suffragettes in the capital. But the path to the voting rights we enjoy today has a much more complicated story. It was a national movement, fought by women and men of all classes, people of all ages and in locations right across the UK. People who lived and worked at places now in the care of the National Trust were also involved and influential throughout the campaign. This year, right across the Trust, properties are delving into their archives for the stories of people who took part in or bore witness to these momentous events. In this five-part series, you'll hear from house stewards, curators, volunteers and experts in a unique account of how trust, people and places help to bring about the freedoms that we enjoy today. For the full story, please do listen from episode one. Last time we heard how trust figures played their part in the war effort and of the pivotal role that Kedleston's Lord Curzon played in the Representation of the People Act passing into law. In this fifth and final episode, we'll learn of the societal and political consequences of restricted female voting rights and how the campaign for female suffrage began to shift its focus to wider social change. I'm Kirsty Wark, and this is Women and Power, a podcast from the National Trust. It's 1918. More than 50 years have passed since John Stuart Mill first took his petition for female suffrage to Parliament. And after decades of writing, lobbying, marching and militancy, women will finally be able to vote in the next general election. But this isn't quite the great spectacle of female empowerment that suffrage campaigners had envisaged. Here's Ruth Colton, Research Associate at the University of Manchester, speaking from the glasshouse at a rainy quarry bank.
The Representation of the People's Act in 1918 increased suffrage to all men over the age of 21, while the chance to vote came a little bit younger for soldiers and sailors who had taken part in the First World War. For women who had fought alongside them as VAD nurses, there was no lowering of that age qualification to vote. Women still had to wait until they were 30 in order to be eligible, even if they'd worked, like Madge and Helen, as VAD nurses.
Rather than being a law that clearly states the boundaries between who can and who cannot vote, the Representation of the People Act is full of caveats that restrict the number of eligible female voters.
If women were living with family members, they wouldn't be listed as an occupier, and therefore they wouldn't have been eligible to vote. For a lot of women who had taken part in the war, their lives changed completely and women were given a lot more freedom. So women started renting properties themselves, living with friends, and they wouldn't have been listed as the occupier on those properties. So even while the war increased a lot of freedoms for women and independence, in a lot of cases what this meant was that those women were not eligible to vote.
The disproportionate way the right to vote is applied doesn't stop here. Suffrage is only extended to women over 30 who meet or whose husbands meet certain qualifications. Even if you're over 30 and living in an eligible property, you don't automatically gain the right to vote. Furthermore, if you fulfil all the criteria and are able to vote on your 30th birthday, you can still find that you veer in and out of franchise at various points throughout your life.
One thing that could quite often happen as well to women was that if they were widowed, then they would be most likely to move in with family members, perhaps with a son or a daughter. And when that happened, they would no longer be listed as the occupier again, and so they would no longer be eligible to vote. So a woman in their lifetime could really move in and out of this eligibility criteria, whereas for men it was always fixed.
We are now in a new world, where women can vote, but some of the old world thinking still prevails. As documented in Lord Curzon's 15 Good Reasons Against the Grant of Female Suffrage pamphlet, political parties still fear the status quo could be disrupted by women's supposed inability to vote with good reason or judgment.
One of the major concerns for those who were against giving women the same rights as men was that women would outvote men. because there were more women in society, and particularly after the First World War. In addition, they thought that women might be more likely to vote for a radical party. It was only just over 40% of women who actually got the vote in the end. And this meant that women couldn't outvote men. Whether or not this strategy worked is debatable, and we're going to take you now to an exhibit to explore this issue further.
Quarry Bank and the village of Stile can be seen as a microcosm of the wider population. Mill records show how the limited right to vote affected the inhabitants of Stile. They make for interesting reading. We join Emma Richmond of the National Trust at Quarry Bank Visitor Centre.
So as we walk up to this display cabinet, you can see the names of all the women who were over 21 who were living in Stile in 1918. In purple are the names of all the women who got the vote, and we've raised up the names of the mill working women who were given the vote, which is only 12 women out of 76. You can really see from this list and from the number of women who weren't given the vote just how disproportionately the franchise was given out in 1918. And in Stile, actually, you saw a lower percentage of women getting the vote. To the percentage nationally, it was around 35% of women in Stile compared to just over 40% nationally. And that's partly because of the makeup of the community here, that it was a lot of working class women, women who might have been sharing homes and might not have been that occupier of the home and therefore not given the vote.
Another unforeseen effect of women's limited franchise is the effect it has on individuals within the community.
So it's hard to say what the impact of getting the vote or not getting the vote would have had on women in the community in Stile. Our records in terms of diary entries and things like that are fairly limited. However, for example, within the mill, we have 76 women working within the mill and only 12 of them were given the vote. That may have meant that the women who were, particularly among the working class community, for example, the women working in the mill, those 12 women who got the vote may have been seen as representatives for the whole of that community. And it may be that other women who were politically engaged but hadn't been given the vote would try and debate and discuss and influence that woman to vote in a way that represented their views because she was their voice.
With the Representation of the People Act passed in February 1918, women don't have to wait long to exercise their new rights, as a general election is held in December of the same year. Despite the fears of the establishment, the restrictions on the number of women able to vote makes little change to the makeup of Parliament. By and large, the same people remain in power, but not for the reasons you might expect. Ruth Colton.
The turnout amongst men was particularly low. This was partly to do with the fact that men were returning from war, many were still injured, and there was also a general dissatisfaction with politics at that time. But the turnout amongst women was particularly high. And even from the moment that the vote was still being cast, many newspapers were commenting on the fact that actually in this election, women probably did outvote men. And certainly that's been the case in pretty much every election ever since.
Although women's voices have finally been heard, there's still work to be done. The suffragists, led by Millicent Fawcett, continue to campaign much as they had before 1918, while Emmeline Pankhurst's suffragettes are dissolved and replaced by the Women's Party, who campaign with the slogan Victory, National Security and Progress. There are also new groups that emerge, who move the focus from suffrage to broader female equality. One such group is founded by Margaret Lady Rhondda, the Welsh suffragette activist. After serving time for her post-box bombing during her time as a suffragette, Lady Rhondda is now behind a new cause. Sophie Duncan is Junior Dean of Arts at the University of Oxford.
She founds the 6-Point Group. They are a focus point, really, for progressive political thought in the 1920s, whose objectives include not just universal suffrage, but also women's custody rights, women's employment rights, things like that.
The 6 points included in the group's manifesto are satisfactory legislation on child assault, widowed mothers and unmarried mothers and their children, equal guardianship for married parents, equal pay for teachers, and equal opportunities for men and women in the civil service. And as well as the manifesto, Lady Rhondda is also the driving force behind the group's literary publication and mouthpiece, Time and Tide.
Time and Tide, a politically liberal, culturally minded magazine. You see a lot of great contemporary writers contributing to it, and it's certainly a way for her to disseminate her ideas and also lots of literature and entertainment.
Time and Tide isn't only used to spread the group's political message. It is also a place to showcase the great contemporary writers of the time, many of whom lived in properties now managed by the Trust.
You have writers including George Bernard Shaw, Virginia Woolf, a real mixture of political and comic writing.
The Six Point Group campaigned right into the 1980s, helping to bring about changes that level the playing field for many in society. The Representation of the People Act of 1918 may not have been the great equaliser that Millicent Fawcett envisaged when she founded the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies in 1897. But what the Act did do was open the valve on a slow and steady stream of change that would allow women to achieve more than ever before. In 1919, Nancy Astor of Cliveden in Buckinghamshire becomes the first female MP to take her seat at Westminster. 1928, equal suffrage is extended to all UK adults over 21. In 1956, legal reforms grant women, teachers and civil servants equal pay. In 1969, voting rights are extended to all UK British adults over 18. In 1970, the Equal Pay Act makes it illegal to pay women lower rates than men for the same work. In 1975, the Sex Discrimination Act makes it illegal to discriminate against women in work, education, and training. In 1979, Margaret Thatcher becomes Britain's first female Prime Minister. In 1997, the general election sees 101 Labour women MPs elected. And in 2018, as I walk through Parliament Square, I pass the statues of great leaders immortalised in bronze. Winston Churchill, Lloyd George, Nelson Mandela, Mahatma Gandhi, and finally, I come to the one I really, really want to see, Millicent Fawcett. And she stands there looking incredibly humble, with this wonderful, wonderful flag in front of her, courage calls to courage everywhere. As you come closer to this statue, what you realise is this has a wonderful band of images of other women who've made such a massive difference. Not only is Millicent Fawcett celebrated here, but all the women that went before. I think many, many women will make a pilgrimage to this statue time and again to get succour in times of trouble. We hope you've enjoyed listening to Women and Power. Remember, Women and Power is more than just this podcast. To celebrate the centenary of the Representation of the People Act, the National Trust is running a year-long programme of talks, exhibitions and installations, as well as publishing guidebooks and online articles. To learn more about the National Trust's Women and Power public programme, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/womenandpower. If you've enjoyed this series of podcasts, you might also enjoy episodes of the National Trust flagship audio programme, the National Trust Podcast. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find great audio. To find out more about podcasts at the Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. From me, Kirsty Warg, thanks very much for listening to Women and Power.